You're listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. This conversation was recorded on the traditional lands of the Kulin Nation. The Wheeler Centre acknowledges their elders, past and present. We pay our respects to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and to the elders of all communities and cultures this conversation reaches. In this episode, you'll hear the fifth talk in the Wheeler Centre's Broadly Speaking series, supported by Christina Campbell Pretty AM and family. As part of our focus on translation and language across three Broadly Speaking events, we're thrilled to present this conversation between Robin Wall-Kimmerer and Tara June Winch, two First Nations writers whose work reflects on Indigenous languages and the languages of the natural world. Robin Wall-Kimmerer is a professor of environmental biology at the State University of New York and an enrolled member of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation. She's also the author of the remarkable best-selling essay collection, Braiding Sweetgrass, Indigenous Wisdom, Scientific Knowledge and the Teachings of Plants. Tara June Winch is a Wiradjuri author, born in Australia and based in France. Her most recent novel, The Yield, won the Christina Stead Prize for Fiction, the People's Choice Award and Book of the Year at the 2020 New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards and the 2020 Miles Franklin Literary Award. Here's Tara.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us for this really special talk today. I'm here talking to Robin Wall-Kimmerer, who's a Potawatomi woman, mother, professor, scientist, and author of soulful, accessible books informed by both Western science and Indigenous teachings alike. She seeks most essentially to encourage people to pay attention to plants. Robin, welcome to the talk today.
Thank you. It's a delight to be with you.
I wanted to ask you first about the act of braiding sweetgrass and this title. If you could tell us about that.
I'd love to. In fact, I have a braid of sweetgrass right here by me. It's a long grass. It can be up to 2 feet long, shiny and so fragrant. It smells like beautiful vanilla. And in our creation stories, in the Anishinaabe as well as the Haudenosaunee creation stories, we understand sweetgrass to be the hair of Mother Earth, that it was one of the first plants to have grown on the first ground there was. And as a plant ecologist, I say that's verified in ecological behavior. That's just what sweetgrass does. It binds up the wounds of the earth. And so that's why we almost always braid sweetgrass and give it to one another as gifts of kindness and regard, because it's a sacred plant. And we braid the sweetgrass like we would braid our beloved's hair, as a sign of relationship, of the goodwill for and the intention of creating beauty and wellness. And so that braid is usually of three strands. And in the book, I use that metaphor as those three strands of different ways that we think and behave as we care for Mother Earth and exhibit this care for her beauty and well-being. And for me, those strands represent Indigenous knowledge, knowing about plants and the right relations in the world, scientific knowledge about plants, because I have both of those in my background. But to me, the most important strand, if there could be one, they're all equal really, is that both Indigenous and scientific knowledges are human knowledges. And for me, it's really the plants that are the knowledge holders. And so that third strand I think of as their knowledge. And what I'm trying to do is to weave this braid of stories made of those different ways of knowing that all lead to this enhanced care for Mother Earth.
You wrote about the understanding the world through the four aspects of being, which is mind, body, emotion, and spirit. Could you expand on that idea for us?
Yeah, that notion comes from one of our Anishinaabe sort of maps of the world that we think of as the medicine wheel, which is a symbol which places all of creation within this whole circle, and then names the parts of those a map really names the places on that mental and spiritual map. And one of the ways that the medicine wheel is understood is just as you said, Tara, that we as human people have mind, intellectual knowledge, right? We have physical knowledge, those things we observe and measure and smell and taste and all of those gifts. But we also have emotional intelligence, and we also have spiritual knowledge. And that we're told that unless we bring all of those ways of knowing to a question, we're probably missing something. And I like to use that medicine wheel both as a writer, and I really am quite intentional about going around that circle and being sure that I have tried to engage what I know from each of those elements and what my readers might know or feel from those elements as well. And that can create a kind of an immersion in a story that helps to connect to people who might have very different orientations to the world. So it's a sacred symbol of our people, but which is also known as a guide to our thinking and our behavior. You know, I should also say that it's important to me as a scientist, because working in institutions of science, Western science so greatly privileges the intellect and that which we can measure, and very explicitly sets aside spiritual and emotional knowledge, subjective ways of knowing. And so I always try to keep that holism of the medicine wheel in mind, because the arenas in which I work and the epistemologies of science would say, no, we don't count those other pieces. And so it's important to me as a touchstone for working in the scientific world to always remember that that's just one way of knowing.
And do you struggle between, by having these two feet in these different worlds, between, you know, our Indigenous culture and knowledge systems and being so deeply entwined in the scientific world as well?
Yes, I do. And, you know, especially I did as a young scientist, where all the messages that come to you are the privileging of Western science, right? And that, of course, is not science, that's scientism. Science is just a way of curiosity and questioning and coming to understand the world. It's scientism which seems so, well, in a way, dangerous to me, because it says that Western science is the only way of knowing. But again, the medicine wheel is really helpful to me in keeping me grounded to say, yes, one does struggle with the privileging of one kind of knowledge. But then I just remember that in a way, Western science is a subset of Indigenous science, Indigenous ways of knowing. And each of those ways of knowing is very good at answering certain kinds of questions. Western science, with its reductionist scientific method way of generating knowledge, is, I like to think of as, an excellent tool for answering true-false questions. And sometimes those are the questions that confront us. Is this true or not? But Western science, scientific ways of knowing, by excluding subjectivity, have no ability to incorporate values or emotion or spirit. And so what I try to think of is that they're different tools. They're different tools for different questions. And if I'm answering a true-false question, I can use Western science adeptly. But when the questions are about right or wrong, what should we do? How should we think about this? Then I want the more holistic lens of Indigenous knowledge.
You mentioned medicine and healing comes up again, and that pull between the deep knowledge and nature, and between sort of science, and I can't help it always sort of refer it back to us speaking during this global pandemic, and during this time when one of our biggest sort of ailments is our depression and our mental health, and that feeling of helplessness in the world, not just with something uncontrollable like a virus, and not just climate change, but democracy around the world. I want to ask you, and this is a lot of pressure, but if you can show us how interacting with nature can heal us.
You're so right of the state in which we are living right now. And I would say that for me, being out on the land, being with nature, has been medicine for me, continues to be, through this trying, troublesome period. And the way that it is medicine, it makes me think where I want to begin with that question is that in the Potawatomi language, all plants are called medicine. And not all the medicine is for us. It might be tree medicine. It might be beetle medicine or blue jay medicine, but they're all called medicine. And when you take apart that word mishkikin in our language, what the word medicine really means is that he or she is healed by the strength of the earth. And that to me speaks volumes, that where does the healing come from? From the strength of the earth and the strength of connection to the earth. And, psychologists, physicians, there's lots and lots of evidence, of course, for the healing power of nature biophysically, that it reduces the presence of being in nature, reduces our stress hormones dramatically, and it has a lasting effect. It reduces blood pressure. It increases endorphins. It has all sorts of biophysical health-promoting effects, including a recent discovery that being in nature actually stimulates your immune system. Nature heals us. Nature, being in so-called nature, which is everywhere outside the built environment, I guess, is therapeutic in a biophysical way. And of course, the mind-body connection means that when our bodies are healthier, so are our minds. But we also know that being with the trees, with the smell of the earth and the sound of running water, also connects us spiritually to intelligences other than our own. That's partly where the comfort for me comes from, is thinking that, in these uncertain and admittedly dark times, there's such pressure that we feel like we have to figure this out. And we're paralyzed because we can't. And I take comfort in knowing that there are intelligences other than our own that can teach us what we ought to do in these times. And so I feel like what I'm doing when I'm out on the land is not only soaking in all of that goodness and that wisdom and healing of the mishkikin, of the strength of the earth, but I'm really trying to listen to those other species. And how would you go through these hard times? Where does reconciliation lie? What is it that we're called to do? And so I find comfort and inspiration in listening to the wisdom of the world.
That's beautiful. I wanted to ask you about the cedar trees and what they mean to the Potawatomi, the metaphor of the trunk that carries the weight. Could you tell us about that a bit?
Yes. Cedar, who we call Gijik in our language, is one of our four sacred medicines. It's also known particularly as a women's medicine. It's a great biophysical healer again. We use it as medicine for, particularly in this time of respiratory infections. Oh, just to smell and breathe in the steam of cedar, you just feel sort of filled with the life of that tree. And in fact, in English, that same tree is known as arborvitae, the tree of life. It's very well named in the way that it strengthens the body, but it also strengthens the spirit. I think sometimes that the gijik or the cedar is one of the trees that was very ancient here and was associated with the world of Sky Woman. And that tree has a mirroring of the way the canopy architecture is and the roots of that tree as well. They are like inverse of one another. And it's such a good teacher of the unseen architectures that are below the ground, that wholeness is made up of that duality of the light-filled and the dark-filled, the sun and the soil. And that's where some of the spiritual power of that tree comes from, is because it is a great connector between the realms of the above and below ground worlds, both physically and metaphorically. So it is one of our great medicines. We use it not only for physical health, but it is a protector as well. A really important plant to keep one in balance and to create a sacred space.
That's beautiful. I wanted to ask you, when we're looking at our forest, our land at this time, when we're finding solace in that place, I wanted to ask you how the sort of colonial capitalist map that sits atop Turtle Island, what it has done over decades and centuries to the identity of Americans.
Wow, that is a question of such gravity and scope. I'll try to answer it in just a little way. And you know what, Tara? I think I will choose to answer that with a very localized piece of Turtle Island, which is dear to me, which tells the story that you're asking about so well. I live here in the heart of Haudenosaunee territory, near to the Onondaga Nation. And Onondaga Lake, which is just a few miles away, is the sacred lake of the Onondaga and all the Haudenosaunee people. It's a mythic place. It's the place where the peacemaker arrived and delivered the great law of peace. It's where human beings decided that they would change their ways and live in harmony with one another. It is the place where the oldest democracy on the planet was first founded, right on the shores of Onondaga Lake. Onondaga Lake was also a cornucopia of earthly gifts, fish and fruit and medicines and water and springs and even salt springs. Everything one needed was as a gift of the land. And it was that way for millennia. And when the capitalist colonial forces came to our territory here, they came with that capitalist lens, colonial lens that you're talking about. And the lake was not sacred to them. Land was not sacred to them. It was property. It was all about rights and power and wealth that they could derive from those forests, those salt springs, the water, the fish. And there is a profound way in which that capitalist, exploitive, colonial worldview virtually buried the indigenous worldview here. And it is written all over the land. You know, a landscape that used to be richly forested is now largely farms and still quite a lot of forest, but very different in nature. It's a fragmented landscape. And Onondaga Lake herself, that sacred place where the peacemaker came, where the great tree of peace was planted, is now an industrial waste zone. The place where the peacemaker walked is literally buried under industrial waste, and buried under the, layered over the indigenous worldview of respect and reciprocity, and the thinking about land as our home, as our sacred home, as our place where we enact moral responsibility. Nope. Under that lens, it became a dumping ground. And the pain and the trauma of that loss is written on the land. It's written on the people. So that's how, in a microcosm, I would say, how has the colonial worldview fragmented, suppressed our way of being? You know, the Onondaga people themselves live on a postage stamp piece of land allotted to them, and it's not even on the lake. They have no legal access other than public land to their own sacred lake. And yet, the people are incredibly strong, resilient guardians of their home places, as despite all of the constraints. And I would say that the plants themselves are resilient guardians as well. In Braiding Sweetgrass, I write about visiting with them those courageous plants that are growing on that industrial waste. And oh, they give me such strength and power to watch them do that, to say, nope, you tried to bury us, but we're not having it. We're coming back. And so for me, they're that's where hope lives, hope and courage, with those plants and those people.
Our stories are very similar. Our people were also disenfranchised from their lands and from their culture, and particularly their language as well, described and could converse with and about a worldview. I think for Australia, and I write about that relationship with our language and land. I think when I look at Australia, in terms of what that colonial capitalist map has done to the identity of Australians, is I feel that it's sort of created a psychic troubles in our collective identity of who we are, because there's such a disconnect between the nature, the native nature that exists there, and the relationship of Indigenous peoples and the British colonial sort of identity that does not belong on a forest language from England, does not belong on the land of the bush landscape, the native environment in Australia. There's this, and I think what it creates is a sort of generations of people who can't reach nature, they can't reach our Black history to make themselves whole. I don't know if that's like that in America as well.
Oh, Tara, I know. I know, and I feel that pain, because our identities, even generations after dispossession, I think our identities still are shaped by our land. The land remembers us, and we remember the land, and that sets up that pain of not being in relation with your own identity and your own land, and it's immensely painful. And the notion that the language of the colonizer doesn't belong and mirror one's landscape is such a powerful idea. I want to hear more about that. relearning language and learning the names of plants and places is an act of recovery, I think. It's an act of what we're all trying to do, which is to come home again to the place where we are known and we know. And that is one of the major wounds of colonialism is that separation. But I do have this faith that even when we're lost, that the land somehow remembers us. And I say that from experience and from listening to uncountable stories of people who have sort of found their way home through relationships with water and mountains and other beings. But one has to have access to them. If the world that we are constrained by and confined to holds none of our relatives and none of our language and none of the sort of the songs that resonate between us, then it is a lonely and crippling place to be.
I had this quote above my desk when I was writing. It was by Ngugi wa Thiong'o, the Kenyan writer, who said that the bullet was the means of the physical subjugation and language was the means of the spiritual subjugation. You write a lot about language. You said that when language dies, so much more than words are lost. Language is the dwelling place of ideas that do not exist anywhere else. It is a prism through which we see the world. How important are languages in our connection back to the earth, to nature?
Oh, that's a powerful quote. I think that learning our languages does create a lens on belonging to the world that is not available in English. English is the language of the colonizer. It is the language of capitalism. And if you look at the very structure of English, there's no mystery why that is. You know, English is a language based on nouns. It is a language in which you and I, Tara, refer to one another with a grammar that we reserve just for humans. I would never say, it is talking. It is asking really interesting questions, right? I would never refer to you as it, but that's what English does for all of our more than human relatives, all the plants and animals. It's the world. And so there's no surprise that this is the language of clear cutting and strip mining and all other kinds of exploitative relations, because language, the English language has objectified the sacred world. Whereas in my language, and I'm dying to hear about yours, it's a language of animacy. We speak about those trees outside, about the soil, about the flowers, the birds, the water. We speak of them as with the same grammar that we would our family, because they're our family. So this imposition, this linguistic imperialism of itting the world is, I think, one of the most dangerous elements of imposition of colonial languages on peoples and places.
We have the same sort of etymology within our language, and I really tried to show that. In my book, I really wanted to show that I didn't ever want to be didactic, because it's within novels, it's a bit different. I wanted to show that our epistemology was there and available to those who seek to become Indigenous to their own country. You've written about that becoming Indigenous as well in your book. For example, there's a bird in our country called a plover. It's a really aggressive bird, and it's sort of seen contemporarily as a sort of a pest and a bird that, you know, swoops at the head and is aggressive and was met with such hatred. But in Wiradjuri, which is my father's language, the word for plover is didadida, and it means protection, basically. And the reason why the plover is sort of aggressive is because it's a protector. It's protecting its young. It's protecting its homeland. And it's an affectionate term that's used within family as well, the didadida. So I wanted to ask you if there were words like that for you that you would give to Americans or those that have made Turtle Island their home that would help them to connect. Is there one or two words that invite them to be Indigenous?
This notion of the invitation to make an authentic home is a powerful thread that connects both of our work, Tara. And it language may be a piece of it, particularly the language or the intention of the language. One of the things that I want to answer this in two ways. Maybe first what is a word that to me shifts the lens that I would want people to know about. And I think I would choose our word for berry. The word min, M-I-N, is our word for berry, and it appears in all of the berry names, like Ode Min, the strawberry, Miskatiz Min, the raspberry, and Minon, the blueberry. But that means berry, but it also means gift. And so it is a recognition of the world as gift. Mm. And to me, that shifts our thinking, that the berries and all of the plants are giving us gifts, and that we are called to give our gifts in return. And I think it's entering into that reciprocity that makes one native to place. If you're a colonist, not thinking about staying, only about owning and exploiting, the world is natural resources, it's not gifts. So if in that word, we can be reminded that everything that we have is the gift of another being and the gift of Shkokmikwe, of Mother Earth, that shifts so much. I think the other thing I would add perhaps about that, and I'd love to know what parallels and how you've explored this as well, particularly, I think, as a scientist and as teaching science students, when I have to refer in its paltry way, English just lets me refer to these wonderful maple trees, for example, that I'm looking at right now, as it. You know, there's no other way to do that. And so I've actually proposed pronouns based on our Potawatomi language that would allow speakers of English not to say it about trees and birds and rivers and fish, that we would have a way to speak of them by calling them ki. Ki as a pronoun to sit right beside he and she, which is often he and she are not necessarily the right ways that we want to connect to the natural world, but as a being, right? A ki. So we could have he, she, ki, and it. And that word ki comes from our word for earth, aki. And from that, from the word bamadesi aki, which means a being of the earth. And it doesn't differentiate as to whether it's a human or a squirrel or a beetle. It is a being of the earth, like a fellow relative. And so in that small way, I've been trying to think about how could these notions of relatedness with the living world become accessible to colonists who want to become, I think of it as naturalized to place. And language, I think, can be a powerful way to do it.
I love that idea because I'm sort of in exile in a way here in another land as well that I've been struggling to connect to. And it's funny in the French language that everything is assigned a gender, actually, he and she. And I love that middle ground, that key. I think it's beautiful. As I said, living in France, but being Indigenous to Australia, I'm now struggling, particularly I've noticed this year as I've spent every day in the forest, to become Indigenous to this place, because no matter where I go outside, I can never find my home. I can never find Nurembang, my country. It doesn't exist in the forest in France. And I'm trying to have reverence for this alien place, this northern hemisphere, to come home here as well. I wonder, and there's that term that you wrote about, that force that makes mushrooms push up overnight. The word isn't for the mushroom, it's for the force. I think it's popawi.
Uh-huh.
And I've been thinking about, I need advice, I guess, Robin. I don't know how to come home here.
Yeah. And I think that you're identifying one of the most powerful, really primal ways that we are missing in our world, even the intention of coming home, of being at home. And Tara, when I travel, I sometimes feel so displaced that I've kind of developed a practice that helps me feel grounded in another place. And it is doing just what you're talking about. As you said, you're in the woods every day. You're coming to know your neighbors, right? Mm-hmm. You're becoming permeable to them and them to you, because that forested world is providing you with a drink of water every day. That forested world is, you know, caressing your skin. It's with that wonderful forest air, you know, to think of oneself as becoming a place in a biophysical way that also becomes a psychological and spiritual belonging as well. I am, as I have written, just crazy in love with photosynthesis. And that great poem of photosynthesis is for me another way to belong when I am feeling displaced. I take a breath and I remember that with the oxygen that I just brought into my body was made for me by those very trees. And then when I breathe out, my exhaled carbon dioxide is going to become a leaf within a few minutes. That makes me belong. That makes me feel like I belong, so long as I'm conscious about that. And so to me, it's the paying attention and the embodied engagement with place that can start to help you feel at home. That's what helps me in faraway places. But you touched on something so beautiful of that we want to be at home.
I want to pick up on what you said about how you, the breath out would become, you would then become the leaf. And it's autumn here, it's the fall. And I remember walking into the forest, and I think because I've been going every day, that I've come to have a sort of kinship because of that close proximity that I've started to read the forest in a way. I remember there was one day, and it had nothing to do with dates and that, you know, structure of church time, Western time. There was one day, some days into the fall, and I had become the fall, and the forest had turned, and it was as if I could smell it. Everything had changed in 24 hours. It had woken up and transformed in that way. And I remember thinking about the lines in wood grain and how the light-coloured wood is when the trees grow fast and the wood is soft in spring and summer. And then the lines, the dark lines in the wood grain is the growth during the fall and winter when the trees grow slow, but they grow hard, have that strength to them. And I could imagine that if someone were to cut to the tree in hundreds of years, they could see me at the beginning of that dark wood grain in that slow entering that period of sort of hibernation and slow growth to sort of gain strength. But then I lost that feeling like a few days later. It was really, my point, I guess, is how do I hold on? How do I not lose my connection when I make connection?
Oh, that is a beautiful story. And that is exactly what I mean when I think about permeability, right? That we become each other. And you used that beautiful word of kinship, which is that belonging, right? You know, that's a really good question. And for me, sometimes, like the experience that you've described, they are fleeting knowings about belonging and relatedness that they, you know, I don't feel like I am acutely aware of it in every moment, and yet it somehow has entered in my bones so that I still know it, even if in that moment I'm not sort of sparkling with that knowing. It's more of a steady kind of belonging. I don't know, except for to say that for me, sometimes those really transcendent times are quite fleeting, but I just remember them and know that it's so true. And truer than anything, those moments of experience when with your whole being, you know that you are now written into that tree, so that you know that tree and that tree knows you. That does not change. Your molecules are in that tree. That tree's way of expressing itself is in you. And I just hang on to that as like the truest thing. There's all these forces that would, you know, ask skeptical forces that would, you know, demand analysis and evaluation of such an experience. But that doesn't make a darn bit of sense to me because it is so true, because you feel it with mind, body, emotion, and spirit. So I guess that's how I would respond to that, with along with the gratitude for you sharing that and that longing to keep that moment alive. I guess I always just have faith that they'll come again, because they do.
Right. Another phenomena that is so foreign to me but has become part of me is mosses. You've written about secret life of mosses. Can you tell us more about that, about why we should pay attention?
Oh, how delightful that you're seeing mosses on your daily forest walks. I can almost imagine. Yeah, mosses are, you know, one of my great companions in the botanical world. And I could speak for hours about the teachings that they have for us. But I guess one of the things I would start with is that because you have fallen in love with them too, I know how that happened, right? It's attention. It's deep attention. You think, oh my goodness, just this green fuzz that I might have walked by because I was attentive, because I was open to the gifts of the world, I suddenly saw this little tiny miniature forest of mosses that just draw your attention in because they're right there at our limits of perception. All it takes is attention and you're drawn into this other world. So to me, mosses are a teacher of attention. They're also a reminder, particularly in the times that we live in, of endurance and what does it mean to be successful. You know, our economic and social institutions have their definitions of what success means, right? Mosses wouldn't recognize those as success, and much of the living world wouldn't either. You know, this notion of being the biggest, the most powerful, the richest, etc. Mosses have a very different definition of what does it mean to be successful. These tiny, tiny plants, so often overlooked, play an outsized role in the ecosystem. They give so much more than they take. They build soil, they generate biodiversity around them, and they ask so little of the world, and yet make all of this beauty and complexity. Small is beautiful, small is successful in the moss world. And they give us also this element of success in that, in the litany of overlapping crises that we are experiencing at this moment, climate change and disease being at the top of our list of urgent concerns, mosses have been on this planet for 350 million years, really longer than that. They are the first plants to come out on the land. And yet, while most other beings that have ever lived are now extinct, mosses have continued and persisted and graced the world with their beauty relatively unchanged for 350 million years through every climate change, through every plague that has beset the world. The mosses are still here. And my fascination with them comes with them as teachers. That's what success is, to live beautifully, to live generously for and persist longevity in beauty and grace. To me, that's success. So I'm endlessly fascinated at how mosses do that. I think of them as our very, very oldest of teachers.
I love that. And you talk about how the mosses give so much more than they take. And I'm thinking, especially, particularly like everyone, as we live in these forced closed quarters again, in this isolation with our children, we're spending so much time with them again. And then it makes me think about motherhood and how that the mother is giving so much more than they're taking, apparently, seemingly, to the child, and how I think we can, when we aren't really our, I'm just thinking about this now, Robin. Bear with me, but yeah. I'm just realizing maybe that I'm not actually my child's teacher. Maybe I'm thinking about this because I've spent so much this whole entire year with a teenager who lost, even though we've always had a garden, we've always immersed ourselves in nature, but who has, because of the world and technology and the internet and social media and all those things that want to give her dopamine in a way that almost nature cannot, I feel maybe I can't be that teacher anymore of giving. I need the mosses to become the teacher. I guess what I'm asking is how do we bring our children back home too with us?
I think you're right, particularly when our kids are teenagers, they need other teachers, right? And how to introduce, you know, sometimes as a mother and now a grandma, and as a teacher and sort of a grandma to my students as well, you know, sometimes I think that one of the most important jobs that we have is of creating relations, of introducing people, of inviting people to come into relationship, to come to be the teacher. And I think there's great wisdom in what you're saying, is provide for our children other teachers. And I'm remembering now about writing about this for my own daughters when they were teenagers too, is the time I was particularly thinking about this, is when I wanted to be sure that they knew how to garden. Not only that they knew how to raise food and beautiful flowers and trees, I wanted them to know those things for self-sufficiency, but I wanted them to have relationship. I wanted them to feel loved by the world and love the world in return, as a kind of a surrogate for my own teaching and love. I wanted to spread that out for them, that they'd always have the love of the garden and the soil and Mother Earth loving them back. And for me, it was just being sure that they were always out there, that they were always connected. They might laugh and say, well, yes, Mom, that's why you made us do so much work outdoors. You made us stack firewood and dig potatoes and all of those things. Yes, I did. Both because I needed their help in doing those things and because I think engagement with the world, you know, with a shovel in your hand and your toes in the dirt, that's where you kind of fall in love with the world and the world will teach you things even if you're resistant to learning. So I think it's just being in the presence, and our role as parents and as teachers is kind of as a translator, you know. Let me introduce you to these beings and see what happens.
I just got so excited, Robin, because my whole world just cracked open, where I can now move all the chores to the outdoors. I could just see it's so obvious. I mean, we're privileged in that way to have space, to have a place for our children to work and to be, you know, to be useful and have purpose in nature. We're so privileged in that way. And I wonder, I'm so excited now for my teenager to get home and chop the wood. I wonder what about those that don't have nature, that are living in cities and that are fearful, because I think it would be the scariest thing right now to be in an urban sprawl during the pandemic. What is your advice there? How to overcome the anxiety of a city?
Tara, I wish I knew how to answer that question. It always puzzles me, because I'm a person who lives on the land and learns from the land. This is a mystery to me. And when I go to spend much time in the city, I'll confess to you, it is not long before I start feeling like a crazy person, because of a kind of sensory overload, and I just can't get my bearings in urban settings. And try as I might, I don't know how to reasonably answer this question. That I can answer it intellectually, but I haven't experienced it. For me, it's that notion that nature doesn't have to be, you know, a wild and beautiful forest and waterfall, that there's nature all around us. There's nature in that little moss in a sidewalk crack, and the raccoons in the park, and all the amazing birds that use the islands of green space. That's nature too. And I think that the same tools of attention and gratitude and reciprocity can be at work in the built environment, in an urban setting. But I say that with all the humility to say that I've never lived in a city, so I don't know that that's true. And if one is bombarded by the stress of the city, can we find that attention? I don't know.
I don't know either, and I have the same psychological and physical reaction when I'm in a city. I kind of end up running just on adrenaline. You know, I can't sleep. I kind of forget to pay attention to my body. I forget to eat, and I am not at the center of myself, and I don't know what the answer is either. It's disconcerting when so much of our world's population are disconnected from nature, that don't see the moss in the crack, and what that means for our future when they cannot or have not had an intimate relationship with the natural world.
You're right. You're right. And it calls out, doesn't it, for this understand, because most people do live in cities, and we could talk all about the prescriptions of the natural world as healing, but it becomes then a huge health disparity between urban dwellers and folks who are living with the privilege of green space. And it does seem like something that we need to address and really talk to our urban naturalist colleagues of how do they do it.
There's some
good homework.
Yeah, reinvent our urban the way we live urbanly, whether it be with community gardens or actually, you know, investing in green space, investing in more community garden. I'm not sure, but I feel like this is such an important sort of issue to look at as we move forward, as we really try and tackle climate change, but not just as an activism, but as something that is deeply felt by each of us, that it's necessary.
I certainly agree. And it makes me feel really inadequate to that task. And it inspires me to reach out and learn some more. And maybe it is, as you say, urban gardens is a really good example, because there, you know, the flora and fauna are different, but maybe the relationship is the same. You're still nurturing life. You're still learning from whatever you're planting and the bugs that are there. And you're still breathing in that beautiful exchange between the plants and the people. So maybe it's there in a different guise. I don't know, and I want to find out.
As we're speaking, it's been 3 days after the US election. We're still waiting for, you know, a result. I wanted to leave with one of your quotes at this, you know, uncertain time about patriotism. You wrote in Braiding Sweetgrass, "If what we want for our people is patriotism, then let us inspire true love of country by invoking the land herself. If we want to raise good leaders, let us remind our children of the eagle and the maple. If we want to grow good citizens, then let us teach reciprocity. If we want to inspire to justice for all, then let it be justice for all creation."
Thank you for invoking those words.
Well, thank you for writing them, Robin. It's been such an honor to talk to you today.
It's been a joy, Tara, and I thank you. In our language, it's a chimigwech.
And in my language, I would say mandangu and all my yinyimara to you. It means thank you and all my respect.
Thanks for listening to Robin Wall Kimmerer and Tara June Winch in conversation for the Wheeler Centre's Broadly Speaking series. Robin's best-selling essay collection, Braiding Sweetgrass, and Tara's Miles Franklin Award-winning novel, The Yield, are both published by Penguin Books Australia and available from Neighbourhood Books, the official online bookseller for the Wheeler Center's Broadly Speaking series. Broadly Speaking is supported by Christina Campbell Pretty AM and family. Find out more about the series and upcoming events at wheelercenter.com.